Welcome back to Music for Life, exploring the purpose and value of music to humanity's enrichment. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. Today's episode is titled Music's Heartbeat, and in our first half, we explored one of the most fundamental elements of music, rhythm. In this half, we will explore the usage of percussion instruments throughout standard music history. Before we do that, there is one other aspect of rhythm that I want to mention that plays a significant part in music history, and that is tempo. Tempo is the Italian word for speed. It's the speed of the pulse, or the speed of the particular timing of all the pitches. Four beats, for instance, might be longer in one piece than in another, just because the tempo is slower. The reason I mention tempo, though, in the context of music history, is that tempo is how we commonly refer to specific movements in the standard fine art repertoire, certain movements or sections of larger works. Back in the Baroque and classical eras, composers would write multi-movement works. Each movement had its own tempo, and it usually was that tempo throughout the entire movement. The best identifying label for each movement, other than saying first movement, second movement, obviously, was to call it by its tempo. And since the common notated language of music was Italian, we used Italian words. So they'd refer to the allegro movement of this concerto, for example, or the andante movement of that sonata. We still do that today. We call the famous second movement of Dvorak's New World Symphony largo. We say the largo from the New World Symphony sometimes. The second movement of Samuel Barber's string quartet that he turned into a piece for string orchestra, he called Adagio for strings because it came from the Adagio movement of that string quartet. So when you go to a classical concert and you see these indented Roman numerals with these strange Italian words after them, those are the tempo titles, if you will, for each movement. And if you know a few of these basic Italian labels, you can gather what to expect in terms of speed from each of the movements, which I think helps when attending a concert, especially if it's a piece you've never heard before. I mean, I still use this if I go to a concert and I see the tempo and I've never heard the piece before. I know what general speed to expect. Okay, so now as promised, let's get into our discussion of percussion instruments. I don't plan to give a blow-by-blow of every percussion instrument there is. There are so many. But let's talk about the general percussion section and its usage throughout music history. The percussion section of the orchestra consists of many drums and noisemakers. It's the loudest group and the most flexible group in the orchestra. There are many standard percussion instruments, but the fact is that percussionists will pretty much and gladly beat on anything. Percussion instruments are sometimes classified into two major categories based on whether they give off definite pitch or not really any pitch at all. The percussion instruments that have definite pitch would be instruments like xylophones, glockenspiels, and marimbas. The timpani, or the kettle drum, also has a definite pitch, and it gives great reinforcement both rhythmically and tonally when it makes a sound in the orchestra. Other percussion instruments have indefinite pitch. If you hear a cymbal crash, you can't really hum what that note is. The same is true of the hit of a snare drum. Percussion instruments are sometimes classified by how they are played. Idiophones, for example, spelled I-D-I-O-P-H-O-N-E-S, they produce sound when the whole instrument vibrates. That includes cymbals, triangles, woodblocks, and other mallet instruments like marimbas and such. The percussion instruments that are known more properly as drums are referring to those that have some kind of membrane stretched over an open area and are played with mallets or bare hands. They include the timpani, snare drum, and congas. And remember, Congo is the country, conga is the drum. Before we get into a sweep of standard music history to see how these instruments have been used, let's get into our Sounds of Scripture segment, where we survey the Bible's many references to music for a longer sweeping historical perspective on our episode's theme. Percussion instruments are mentioned in the Bible, particularly as part of the Hebrew musical culture. The most commonly mentioned percussion instrument is the tof, T-O-F, which is usually translated tabre or timbrel. You can think of a tambourine or at least a skin stretched across a circular frame, which describes actually many drums in general. In describing the angelic creation Lucifer, the prophet Ezekiel describes his tabrets as being created in him along with his pipes. These two instruments are symbolic of the great musical genius created in this cherub, and the latter represents a wind instrument, but the former, the tof, represents a rhythm section. The tof is mentioned earlier in biblical history, first chronologically in Jacob's and Laban's time. That can be found in Genesis 31, verses 25 to 27. In this reference, it's used in the context musically as being paired with a harp, and paired also contextually with mirth or happiness. Next, we see it being used in Miriam's dance after the Israelites crossed the Red Sea. This instrument and the art of dance were commonly paired together in ancient times, and the Bible favors this combination of arts. The book of Jeremiah talks of a future time when God will rebuild Israel. He says, "You shall again be adorned with your tabrets, and shall go forth in the dances of them that make merry." This new age of dance is prophesied in Jeremiah 31, verse 4. A similar statement can be found in Psalm 68, verses 24 to 25. "They have seen your goings, O God, even the goings of my God, my King, in the sanctuary. The singers went before, the players on instruments followed after. Among them were the damsels playing with timbrels." How similar to Jeremiah's prophecy about God adorning the virgin with tabrets again. Here we have the singers in front, the minstrels, the Hebrew implying string players, in the rear, and the group of damsels in the midst of them performing a dance with timbrels to complement the singing of praises. Now back to the chronological usage of the tof. We talked about it in Jacob and Laban's time and in Miriam's time. It's also mentioned later in the time of Jephthah, in the infamous moment where his daughter came out to meet him to the sound of that instrument, along with dancing, and that account can be found in Judges 11, verse 34. It's mentioned next in the time of Samuel's schools of the prophets, which we have discussed on a couple of occasions in earlier episodes. The mention of this instrument with others like pipes, harps, and bagpipe-type instruments implies a grand ensemble of families of instruments. So the tof here could imply not just one timbrel, but a family of percussion instruments. Here's a quote about the music program at those schools, which can be found in Lang's commentary. Quote, "The music which went before them shows that in these societies, religious feeling was nourished and heightened by sacred music, though music was also elsewhere cultivated. The four instruments which accompanied them indicate the rich variety and advanced culture of the music of that day." Unquote. We find the tof being used by singing and dancing women slightly later in Saul's reign. This is in the time of young David, who just received much national acclaim for his defeat of Goliath. 1 Samuel 18, 6-7 says that the women came out of all cities of Israel, singing and dancing, to meet King Saul with tabrets, with joy, and with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s." This song was sung with the tabrets as well as instruments of music, literally thirds in the Hebrew. That's what that phrase translates to. The translation of thirds into the English phrase instruments of music could actually mean that the women were using a triangle or triangular shaped instrument in their song. Some suggest it was a sistrum, a jingling, rattling instrument associated mostly with Egypt, but also heavily associated with use by women in pagan ceremonies to use its sound to affect the spirits in certain ways. That's how that particular instrument was used in the Egyptian culture. The approval, though, by the biblical chronicler of this instrument may cause doubt that it was, in fact, a sistrum, and it could have been a triangle, or an instrument with three parts of some sort. It may have been even a three-stringed fiddle. Or it may refer to singing in the consonant intervals of thirds, along with the instruments, or with each other. The timbrels are mentioned next in 1 Chronicles 13, where David, now king of Israel, is attempting to move the Ark of the Covenant back to Jerusalem. This happened along with much musical fanfare, including these percussion instruments. 1 Chronicles 13, verse 8 reads, "And David and all Israel played before God with all their might, and with singing, and with harps, and with psalteries, and with timbrels, and with cymbals, and with trumpets. You might have noticed another percussion reference there, and that's the cymbals. This is the first chronological reference to these percussion instruments. The Hebrew word here is metzelet. The parallel account, as told in 2 Samuel 6, verse 5, uses a different Hebrew word for the cymbals, which is tseletzal. Metzelet is used 13 times in the Old Testament and is always used in plural form. Jacinius' Hebrew Chaldee lexicon notes that it is dual, or as a pair of cymbals, in other words. It comes from a root meaning to tingle or quiver, and this stands to reason in the fashion that cymbals are used when two are struck together. 1 Chronicles 15, verse 19 tells us that they were made of nechoshet, a Hebrew word used interchangeably for copper or bronze. The other word translated cymbal, as I said, is tseletzal. It is translated cymbal three times and once as locust. The word can mean buzzing. Jacinius says it means to tinkle, to clink, as a bridle or bell, the sound of wings even, which is probably why it works as locust, though it's not the common Hebrew word for locust. As an instrument, it might have served a different function than the metzelet. Psalm 150, verse 5, which contains two of the three tseletzal references, states that they were loud and high-sounding, the latter being the Hebrew word teruah, which is usually used for the sound of trumpets, indicating a loud blast, so the high-sounding tseletzal, or the blasting cymbals. One other percussion instrument might be found right here in Psalm 150 as well, but the King James Version translates it as cornet. But the word has nothing to do with a trumpet. The word menana actually means rattle. It comes from a root meaning to shake, tremble, or even sift. This definition supports the idea that this was a rattle, similar to our modern maracas, but possibly at that time a sistrum, if that was in fact used in the Hebrew culture. After King David's time, most of the percussion references pertain to the cymbals, not to the tof anymore. Cymbals are also mentioned in the dedication of the first temple in King Solomon's day. They are mentioned along with singers, harps, trumpets, and an instrument that likely resembled the bagpipes or Ulian pipes. This account is found in 2 Chronicles 5. Later, King Hezekiah, when restoring that temple, set the Levites in the house of the Lord with cymbals, with psalteries, and with harps, according to the commandment of David and of Gad the king seer and Nathan the prophet, for so was the commandment of the Lord by his prophets. And that's found in 2 Chronicles 29:25. Cymbals are part of the Davidic order of the Hebrew culture. Even in Zerubbabel's day, when the second temple was being built, Ezra records that the dedication of the temple's foundation had priests in their apparel with trumpets, and the Levites, the sons of Asaph, with cymbals to praise the Lord after the ordinance of David, king of Israel. That's Ezra 3, verse 10. The musical service had to be established after the ordinance of David, and it included these cymbals. Later, when Nehemiah restored Jerusalem's wall, the dedication of the wall included these priestly percussionists. Nehemiah 12:27 reads, "And at the dedication of the wall of Jerusalem, they sought the Levites out of all their places to bring them to Jerusalem to keep the dedication with gladness, both with thanksgivings and with singing, with cymbals, psalteries, and with harps." Finally, in addition to these percussion instruments contributing to the musical texture, they also served a unique function for the conductor. Notice this reference in 1 Chronicles 16, after David pitched a tent for the Ark of the Covenant in Jerusalem. Verse 4 of that chapter reads, "And he appointed certain of the Levites to minister before the Ark of the Lord, and to record and to thank and praise the Lord God of Israel." Verse 5 states that Asaph was the chief of all these instrumentalists, and due to his eminent role, he, quote, "made a sound with cymbals," unquote, thus setting him apart from the rest. This is likely referring to a leadership position similar to that of conductor. Alfred Sendri says in his book Music in Ancient Israel that the role required Asaph to give, quote, "the signal with cymbals to start singing," unquote. The Moffat translation even renders it Asaph always beating time with cymbals. Just as is God's method in other aspects of organization, music requires someone to lead, someone to establish and maintain the tempo, either in rehearsal or in performance or in both. Alfred Sendri says that a larger group of singers or musicians has to be conducted by a leader in order to perform with the required rhythmic precision is an axiom valid in ancient times just as it is today. But how was music actually conducted in ancient Israel? Sendri asks. To answer this question, we have to resort again to analogies found in the musical practice of other peoples of antiquity. Particularly significant in this respect, he writes, are the institutions of the Egyptians, which have mostly influenced the musical practice of the Hebrews. In excavated Egyptians' bas-reliefs and paintings, dancers, processions, and festivals are reproduced, in which all kinds of noise-making instruments, clappers, cymbals, sistra, hand drums, and also time beaters are depicted. This has led many to the conclusion that in ancient times, and this is still in the quote from Alfred Sendri, music was led by presenters with the aid of loud rhythmical instruments, consequently by way of beating the measure. This has been Sounds of Scripture. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music's Heartbeat, and we have been exploring one of the most fundamental elements of music, rhythm, as well as the usage of percussion instruments throughout standard music history. And let's do that now. Going back to the Baroque era, the most common percussion instrument used in the orchestra was the timpani. They usually were used in pairs, emphasizing the two most important pitches in any given tonality. You hear it here in the beginning of this rondo by Jean-Joseph Mouret, made famous by the Masterpiece Theater TV series. There would be too many pieces of Baroque, classical, romantic, and modern music to play just to highlight the timpani, but rest assured that many of the examples we will play throughout the remainder of the episode will include the timpani. Another rabidly famous timpani passage can be found in the opening of Richard Strauss's tone poem, Also sprach Zarathustra. This is not from the Baroque era, but it is a classic example of the timpani. But staying with the Baroque era, the timpani wasn't the only percussion instrument used in this time. The snare drum was also used in orchestral music, but it was much more rare. In this chorus from the oratorio Judas Maccabeus, Handel employs the snare drum to help illustrate the text, which reads, "See the conquering hero comes, sound the trumpets, beat the drums." We're going to listen to the tail end of this chorus, which leads right into a march. So you will hear extensive use of the snare drum, which was not that commonly used in the orchestra back in the early 18th century. That was the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, with Sir Neville Mariner conducting, performing the chorus See the Conquering Hero Comes, and the subsequent march from G.F. Handel's oratorio Judas Maccabeus, which employed the use of snare drum in the orchestra. As we move into the classical era now, the timpani is still the most favored percussion instrument of the orchestra, but occasionally another percussion instrument would be employed for a specific effect, just as Handel orchestrated the snare drum into a chorus that sang about the beating of the drum. In his Turkish-themed opera, Abduction from the Seraglio, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart made use of a common Turkish percussion instrument, the cymbals. You hear that from the outset of the opera, even in the opening instrumental movement known as the overture. Listen for the use of cymbals, but you will also hear the ever-common timpani in the orchestra as well. And here's Sir Colin Davis conducting the Staatskapelle Dresden in just the last half of the overture to Mozart's opera, Abduction from the Seraglio. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we have been exploring one of the most fundamental elements of music, rhythm, in this episode that I've titled Music's Heartbeat. We are also exploring the usage of percussion instruments throughout standard music history, which we're doing right now. That was the overture to Mozart's opera Abduction from the Seraglio with the Staatskapelle Dresden conducted by Sir Colin Davis. And it was an example from the classical era of the standard timpani being used as rhythmic punctuation in the orchestration, but Mozart also employed the cymbals, a percussion instrument common to the Turkish-sounding music, since the opera's plot had a heavy Turkish element to it. As we move into the Romantic era, the timpani still maintains its status as the star percussion instrument of the orchestra. With the Romantic era philosophy of bigger is better, though, composers started requiring more than just the pair of timpani on the tonality's two most important pitches. Sometimes composers required a third timpani, maybe a fourth, and in some cases, even two sets of four timpani each. My examples from the Romantic era won't venture into those examples, though, but in a previous episode I did play something of Hector Berlioz, where he used all those timpani to depict the sound of thunder. So, I want to play other interesting percussion additions that joined the timpani from time to time. One percussion instrument that we see more of in this era is the bass drum. This large, loud instrument certainly fit right in to the massive orchestra of the Romantic era. Here's an example of the use of the bass drum in Giuseppe Verdi's frightening Dies Irae movement from his Requiem. The bass drum provides some syncopation on what we call the offbeats. The entire orchestra rests for these moments when the bass drum plays, and it reminds me of what one orchestration textbook said, that if you want to have the bass drum play loudly, don't have anyone else in the orchestra play, because you wouldn't hear them anyway. So that was the Dies Irae from Verdi's Requiem, performed by the Vienna State Opera Chorus and the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, Claudio Abbado conducting. You heard the standard timpani, of course, but I played that to give an idea of what the bass drum sounds like, particularly when it's played loudly. I want to play another example from the Romantic era, this one by Camille Saint-Saëns, a French composer famous for his chamber work Carnival of the Animals. Its most famous movement is the swan and features the cello. But in this movement, Fossils, he makes prevalent use of the xylophone, an instrument played with mallets being struck on pitched wooden blocks of various sizes, laid out in a keyboard-type format with the large lower blocks on the left and the small higher blocks on the right. That was Fossils from Camille Saint-Saëns' Carnival of the Animals, performed by members of the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. We've been exploring the use of percussion in the standard orchestra throughout history. The timpani has been the common element, but we've noticed that composers started expanding the role of percussion in the Romantic era. This reaches its height in the 20th century, the so-called modern era, where percussion and varieties of different noisemakers take on a more prominent role in the 20th century orchestra. I find it interesting how Sergei Prokofiev uses the castanets of all things in his Piano Concerto No. 3. Here's a portion of the first movement. Thank you. So that demonstrated the use of castanets in the 20th century orchestra in Prokofiev's third piano concerto, first movement. And you even heard a little tambourine shimmer there at the end. The percussion, noisemakers, and percussive sounds in general were taking on a more prominent role in the 20th century. One of the most important composers of this time period was Aaron Copland, and he used a massive amount of percussion in his work Lincoln Portrait. I've played a bit of this before, but I want to play a particular part of this again, just so you can hear the variety of percussion instruments being employed in this 20th century ensemble. Now, we heard an example from Aaron Copland at the very beginning of this episode, but I want to play this snippet from Lincoln Portrait. You'll hear the timpani, bass drum, snare drum, cymbals, gong, xylophone, glockenspiel, which is like a xylophone but with metal bars instead of wood, and sleigh bells. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music's Heartbeat, and we have been exploring one of the most fundamental elements of music, rhythm, as well as the usage of percussion instruments throughout standard music history. That was a portion of Aaron Copland's Lincoln Portrait, which makes extensive use of a heavily populated percussion section. You heard the Seattle Symphony with Gerard Schwartz conducting. The 20th century was a time when percussion took on a more prominent role in the orchestra, and it wasn't just even these standard percussion instruments that you heard. Sometimes composers would use all sorts of strange sounds to get a percussive effect from the orchestra. I don't have any time to play any examples of those, but you can take my word for it. So we have finished exploring the standard percussion of the standard orchestra from the Baroque era, when composers used mostly just a pair of timpani, to the modern usage of percussion, which includes all sorts of percussion instruments, even some unconventional or non-traditional sounds from time to time. Now let's talk about how percussion is used in early music education, and for that we will get into our Classroom Corner segment, where we explore different methods and curricula for introducing young people
all right,
to
let's
music.
Start with strong, weak, weak. Are you guys ready?
Yeah.
Ready, and strong!
This is an elementary music class here at the Imperial Academy of Edmond performing on percussion instruments. These are kindergartners, first graders, and second graders with their teacher, Alicia Lancaster, one of my assistants here at Imperial Academy and Armstrong College, and she helps a great deal with scripting this show. Percussion instruments are used heavily in early music education. The immediate feedback from these instruments is quite satisfying for children, which is why so many five-year-olds tell me that the instrument they want to learn is drums. So don't be alarmed, parents. That's normal. But it's not just satisfying for children to play these kinds of instruments, it's also educational. As we mentioned briefly in our episode on folk music, the method of music education developed by Karl Orff incorporates the use of percussion instruments. Teachers who use this method of learning call these instruments Orff instruments, and as mentioned before, they include pitched instruments like xylophones and glockenspiels, as well as noisemakers like castanets, maracas, triangles, and conga drums. A precursor to introducing these Orff instruments is using body percussion, taught in early childhood. This is basically what it sounds like. It includes clapping, stamping, vocalization even, and tapping. Many recycled household objects may even be used as a simple percussion instrument. This helps develop a basic understanding of beat, tempo, meter, rhythm, and rhythmic patterns early on in a child's life. The immediate feedback that a child receives from playing a percussion instrument is beneficial. When a child hears the sound an instrument makes when it is struck, it helps them link sound and movement. This stimulates the left and right hemispheres of the brain, developing stronger motor responses. Also, when playing the instrument, new nerve connections are created in the brain, improving their dexterity. Learning how to play pitched percussion, like the xylophone or glockenspiel, requires note reading even, and this sets a good foundation for learning other instruments of the orchestra later on. This has been Classroom Corner. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today we have been exploring one of the most fundamental elements of music, rhythm. In this episode that I've titled Music's Heartbeat, we are also exploring the usage of percussion instruments throughout standard music history. In the standard orchestra, we have seen abundant use of the timpani, some frequent use of cymbals and snares, as well as other percussion instruments adding garnish to the musical repertoire from time to time, bass drums, xylophones, gongs, etc. In the popular idioms of the 20th century, however, percussion plays a critical role in the various styles of popular music. It usually comes in the form of a grouping of percussion instruments known as a drum set or a drum kit. Though it has many variations, there are several elements on each drum kit that are pretty standard. And to walk us through that, let's talk to a drummer. This will serve as our backstage banter segment, where we interview performers on the concert circuit today for their perspectives on music. Okay, I'm here on the Armstrong Auditorium stage. I'm with drummer Jamar Poteet, and he is providing the percussion for a jazz concert we have here this week. And Jamar, why don't you just take us around this drum kit, give us a little demonstration of that.
Okay. For this concert, we'll actually be using, this is you guys' kit, which I love. It's a Yamaha Maple Custom, so I just love maple wood. Starting with the kick.
And the kick is basically what we call the bass drum or the kick drum.
The bass drum, the kick drum, It's basically, as far as in the jazz realm, when they started using the kick drum, back then, 30s, 40s, upright basses weren't amplified. So kick drum would always be used to kind of amplify that sound across the big band. So they'd constantly, you know, have that thing going. So it's just a constant underlining pulse with that walking bass line. So it kind of reinforces that. Now when you use a kick, it's more of a accent or a punctuation on a hit. As far as in jazz, the toms, it came from kind of the Native Americans that were here in North America, and then the African drums that were there on the continent of Africa. They just kind of integrated all this into the kit. Snare drum came from the European style, all the classical stuff that was already going on. So So all this stuff is kind of mashed into one, which is why I love drum set, because you're able to function as a musician, as a percussionist, and not just a drummer. And you're playing multiple layers at one time, so really, it's really a challenge, but it's fun.
And play a little of these different toms, the different sizes, okay. So one's a little higher, one's a little lower.
Yeah, so we have a 12 here, and then a 14 floor.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And then the snare drum, of course, that's a pretty common sound.
It's one of the most versatile instruments, I think, on the kit. For here, I'll have it off some tunes.
So the snare is not touching the bottom of the drum.
The snares aren't touching yet.
And then when it touches it.
So when you turn it on, it totally changes the timbre of the drum.
So you're going to use it on for most of it.
Yep. Then when you go to soloing, stuff like that, maybe some Latin stuff, I'll turn it off because it'll really match and add a fourth layer to the toms that are already happening. So
that high one is the snare drum without the snare on it. And then explain the cymbals to us here.
Probably my favorite part of the kit. I'm using hi-hats, Zildjian A Custom hi-hats. I love them because they really cut through, and I want my hi-hats to cut through. And in jazz, that 2 and 4, that chick, is what you want to hear. It's that timekeeper.
Right, demonstrate a little bit of that.
So you've got that. That's usually what you use most of the time. So,
It's two little cymbals that you're pushing together with a pedal.
Yep. You can get a million things out of it. You can get just playing them with sticks also.
Right.
Which you'll hear a lot of that going
on.
On my left, or directly in front of me, is a 20-inch vintage Bliss Dream cymbal. I love this company. They make gongs, and they started making cymbals. And they just have revolutionized the way cymbals sound, especially in the jazz realm. This 20 is very washy. It's vintage. It's old and dark. Sounds great.
So you're hitting it in different places to get different colors out of it.
You can get a lot of different colors out of them. Very washy. They sound like gongs to me.
Mm. Right.
See how dark that is.
Finger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just, man, an amazing cymbal. So I'll play it with mallets too, and it'll just get a very dark, something you would use in an orchestra for orchestral use. So
nice.
On my right side, I have a Bliss Dream cymbal. This is a 22-inch. So it's a little bit larger. And this is really on my right side because it's my right hand, so it does a lot of the timekeeping.
Mm.
And it really pierces through the band. And it just gives an amazing sound. It's not as washy as the 20-inch, but... but still has a great, great sound, and it rings on forever.
Awesome. Such a versatile piece of equipment here, all these different components come together. I know you're going to be... using all of it, and you're trying to get used to it now, so I don't want to keep you from your practicing. But maybe we could just listen in a little bit as you just get kind of used to all the components.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks very much for talking with me. I'll let you play around with
it
a little bit. I really appreciate it. You are listening to Music for Life. I'm your host, Ryan Malone. This is KPCG. Today's episode is titled Music's Heartbeat, and we have been exploring one of the most fundamental elements of music, rhythm, as well as the usage of percussion instruments throughout standard music history. And just as a reminder, you can follow this show on Twitter for updates and some cool links from time to time. The Twitter handle is at MusicForLifePCG. Music for Life PCG. Finally, let's have our dessert for today, where we hear some lighter fare, usually an example from the popular or folk tradition, to end the program. For dessert, I want to play a recording of a famous jazz artist who was known for his interesting use of rhythm and meter, composer and jazz pianist Dave Brubeck. You might know him by this piece, Take Five, from his album Time Out. This piece was composed by saxophonist Paul Desmond, with whom Brubeck collaborated for many years, and this piece attracted many new listeners to the jazz genre. In fact, it was the biggest-selling jazz single to date. You might notice the 5-beat pattern in the meter. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. One of Brubeck's contributions to jazz was his unconventional use of meter and rhythm. On the same Time Out album was another composition of his that became quite popular, Blue Rondo a la Turque. It has a heavily multi-meter feel. What contributes to this is the fact that even though it's 9-8 for this section that I'm going to play, the 9-8 isn't stressed in the typical 3 plus 3 plus 3 way that we heard in part 1 of the episode, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's grouped as 2 plus 2 plus 2 plus 3. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Which gives it an interesting irregularity or asymmetry to the bars. So that's a little of Dave Brubeck's Blue Rondo a la Turk. But for dessert today, I'm going to play It's a Raggy Waltz. Listen for the changing stress patterns of the beat, juxtaposing the waltz feel against the two-beat pattern feel, somewhat of a hemiola, as we talked about earlier. Definitely some complex rhythms in this as well. And of course, listen for the use of the drum kit in the rhythm section. It's a Raggy Waltz here on Music for Life. You have been listening to Music for Life. From the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus, I'm Ryan Malone. Thanks for joining me.